There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reeswood, and I'm your host on today's program. Oh, the FCC was busy this week, especially at their meeting on Tuesday, November 26th. They made some important decisions about low-power FM and its future, and also tried to tackle cable television, although someone might say that Chairman Martin had something handed to him. We'll get to that and some other great news, or not so great news. Do stay tuned. So as I just said, the FCC met on Tuesday, the 26th of November. It's kind of a epic meeting, both because the lineup of issues to be discussed at the meeting was changing as they went down, and the meeting even happened late. But what came out of it were some interesting changes with regard to low-power FM. That's what I'll take up first here. There's a lot of fans of low-power FM stations pretty happy. No, the FCC cannot make the major change that needs to happen, which is to have the current restrictions on the number of stations that can be on the air lifted. That's up to Congress. But Chairman Martin did sign on with the commission's Democrats, Jonathan Adelstein and Mr. Copps, to go ahead and put some protections in now for low-power FM. Amongst the things that the FCC decided on the 26th was that low-power FM stations, you know, these nonprofit low-power community stations, can be sold from one nonprofit to another, but did tighten up the rules on local programming because it is determined and decided to be a local service. It should not be airing primarily satellite or network or non-local programming. And also clarified that there is a limit of ownership of one low-power FM station per group. And the idea, again, is that low-power FM is intended to be a community service, not necessarily a network service, not to be turned into the likes of Clear Channel. But another interesting decision doesn't regard low-power FM directly, but regards the stations which, in a lot of ways, compete with low-power FM stations, and these are called FM translator stations. It's something which you've spoken about here on Media Geek quite a bit, especially when my pal John Anderson of DIYmedia.net is in the house. And these are stations which whose only purpose is to rebroadcast the signal of a full power station. These are low power stations. Translators in the non-commercial arena, so stations which retransmit the signal of a non-commercial station, can be anywhere, and there are currently no ownership limits on them. And often they take up slots on the dial, which could go to a fully local, locally produced low-power FM station. Instead, these translators, which can and must only rebroadcast the signal of a larger station, often are really just a network of stations rebroadcasting the signal from just one station, such as the Calvary Chapel Church in Twin Falls, Idaho, which feeds hundreds of translator stations across the country with non-local programming. So in 2003, the FCC had a window for applications for new translators and was utterly besieged. And what turned out of that is that a vast majority of the licenses for new translator stations went to just a few applicants who were able to flood the system. and able to get these licenses and have been since then basically dealing in them, making quite a bit of money selling them off to other mostly religious organizations. But what the FCC decided on the 26th is that they're going to limit themselves to processing only 10 of the pending applications for each organization that's put in any applications for translators. Now, these are only for 10 pending applications, so for any construction permits or station licenses that have already been given out of that processing window, those are already sold, but in many cases, lots of applications are pending. And then they're also requiring that the group filing these applications are to decide which 10 are to be dealt with before any settlement window opens. And a settlement window is when there are competing applications in a particular market, when two or more groups have decided they would like to have a particular frequency for a translator, then a settlement window opens to figure out who gets that frequency. So anything that limits, especially the sort of wholesale trade in translators, has some opportunity to also preserve frequencies that would be available for low-power FM stations. Also, one thing about low-power FM that dates back to the service's creation back in 2000 is that it's not a primary service in the same way that a full power station is. And so a low power FM station doesn't enjoy the same protections against interference that, say, a full power station like Community Radio WEFT, where Media Geek originates, enjoys. So that if a full power station in the same region or even on a close frequency to a low power station decide to up its power in a way in which it is permitted to do so, under current rules, and it impinged on that LPFM signal, the LPFM station would have no standing to have that dealt with. And in the most extreme case, might actually have to go off the dial in order to allow the full power station to expand its power, its range, because it has more standing at the FCC. So what the FCC did on the 26th is adopt an interim policy requiring that full-power FM stations that are improving their facilities in such a way that their improvement would interfere with an low-power FM station to work with the low-power FM station to find a way to eliminate or minimize the interference. If no resolution can be found, the full-power station's application would not be processed. So that means the FCC may hold on processing an application to expand service, expand power by a full power station until and unless it's able to work out some sort of agreement with a low power FM station. Now, this is just an interim policy, but I think what it does is it marks away. It looks like the FCC wants to move towards providing greater protections for low power FM stations. And also, the FCC went ahead and urged Congress to repeal the ban on the FCC making changes that would eliminate protections for full power stations from third adjacent channel interference from low power FM. And that basically says that they're asking the Congress go ahead and get rid of the ban they passed in 2000, which greatly reduced the number of low power FM stations that could be on the air when it said that 100 watt low power FM stations must obey the same spacing requirements as stations of 1,000 watts and more on the dial. Which then meant that you could not have low-power FM stations in a lot of major markets, especially New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and even other very crowded dials where you might be able to have them if the spacing requirements are lower. Congress passed that law as part of a larger omnibus budget bill. It was snuck in and preserved through a lot of last-minute back-channel negotiations. It was urged by the National Association of Broadcasters, who had distributed CDs of supposed interference of these 100-watt stations with 1,000-watt and larger stations because they were spaced a little bit closer on the dial. Most research has shown that to be bogus. Even the MITRE study, which was required by Congress at that same time to look into that issue, concluded that no real interference risk happens with low-power FM stations being close to space closer on the dial to high power stations, as the FCC had originally proposed in 2000 and is now again asserting is the way to go, which would allow there to be a lot more FM stations. Whether or not it actually gets taken up into Congress, we have yet to see. It has been taken up by the Senate Commerce Committee and passed by the Senate Commerce Committee. And then it goes to the floor in the Senate. We'll see what happens in the House. Many bills to repeal this ban have come up through Congress and gotten lip service and even pretty good treatment in places like the Senate Commerce Committee, but then failed to get to the floor or pass. But then the FCC did a little bit more on the low-power FM front. They issued a notice of proposed further rulemaking. So what this means is they're looking at passing a few more rules regarding low-power FM, and they're looking for comments on potentially giving low-power FM stations a status superior to that of FM translators. And I think this is something which a lot of us who've been observing wholesaling of FM translator stations really been hoping would happen. Since FM translators are supposed to be pretty much on the lowest class of service on the FM dial because they simply do just only repeat the signal of a full power station. And interestingly enough, are also stations which are low power, like low power FM, but allowed to be spaced closer on the dial to high power stations than low power FM stations are. And is something which the National Association of Broadcasting vigorously defends. Although that seems quite paradoxical to their position on low-power FM stations. As well, the FCC is looking at the relationship between low-power FM and full-power stations to see what permanent rules can be adopted in order to avoid having changes in full-power stations preclude the continued operation of a low-power FM facility. It seems kind of silly to create this new service of low-power FM, put these stations on the air, but then have them threatened and kicked off the air because higher-power stations decide to up their power even more and nudging them out. One possibility is that full-power operators would have to pay the cost of relocating a low-power FM station to different channels or to different transmitter site locations in order to get their higher power out of the deal. And finally, there are some proposals for revising how the low-power FM signal coverage is defined, looking at contour protection, which is really based upon actual surveys, actual engineering reports on the coverage of the signal, versus there's currently sort of a simpler scheme in place based upon strict mileage separations between stations. So that's something that the FCC is looking into and wants comment. That was something which Chairman Martin was really the crucial decider in this. He is the Republican leader of the FCC and siding with his fellow Democrats on this. It did pass, although his fellow Republicans, Deborah Tate and R. McDowell, had concerns with parts of the low-power FM decision made on the 26th, especially with regard to the protection of low-power FM stations in the face of translator stations. And just something I need to remind people about, because, you know, I try to be a bit longitudinal here at MediaGeek and keep track of news stories that may not be on the forefront, but are kind of something we've talked about weeks ago or months ago, but are relevant, is that at the same time, the National Association of Broadcasters is making a big push to allow AM stations to have FM translators. So that, well, they want to allow a regular AM station, no matter what it is, to have an FM repeater station in order to repeat its signal, to allow them to have perhaps better coverage at night, where the AM dial is at this point pretty chaotic and pretty difficult to tune in a lot of stations. And of course, those would be those same translator stations, which are allowed to be spaced closer on the dial than a regular low-power FM station. And so if the FCC goes forward and possibly giving LPFM predominance, that might really threaten the ability to get more translator stations on repeating AM signals. And that's something which generally a lot of people in the public interest community have opposed. It's certainly something I oppose, since I believe that a particular company, Clear Channel, or other large radio holder wants to have FM stations, they usually do, and they can buy them. And people who have gotten AM stations knew what they were getting into. And you are listening to Media Geek. My name is Paul Reismanel, and I'm your host. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. And periodically, I catch up on the news. We have a few shows where I don't have so many news headlines, or in this case, we have a week when a whole lot happens. The FCC has a big old meeting when they pass a lot of things through, and so I try to catch up because it is important to understand our ability to communicate, whether it is on the radio, whether it's on television, whether it's on the internet, or in other arenas, is affected by policy decisions, affected by laws, is affected by a lot of things that happen. And a lot of these stories get covered in the mainstream press, but they're often shunted away in the business pages, and they're certainly not at the top of the hour on television news reports if they get covered at all. So I try to highlight them and give them a little bit of context, and to especially contextualize them from the standpoint of the freedom to communicate. Media Geek is online at MediaGeek.net. That's the blog, which is updated still here and there, as I try to have the time to keep up with everything. And then you can get the radio show online at radio.mediageek.net. The interesting thing I found, I've been blogging since 2000 about these issues, about media ownership, about media regulation, also trying to as well cover things and that directly relate to our ability to communicate and highlight people who are doing very interesting independent media things. And I've been producing this radio show since 2002. And one of the interesting things that's happened is that at that time, I was one of the few bloggers, period, one of the few bloggers covering anything in this territory. And at this point, in 2007, I believe my voice is pretty small by comparison. And I consider that to be a good thing. I consider it to be a very good thing. Of course, many more organizations have adopted blogging, especially the growing public interest sector and the public interest sector in communications organizations like Public Knowledge, Free Press, you know, organizations like the Media Access Project, and all the various researchers and people working within these groups have embraced blogging as well. So there's really so many more resources out there for finding out this news and getting really great analysis. And what I especially enjoy is getting analysis from researchers and analysts who are doing this basically full-time, and doing this full-time not in service of the likes of AT&T or other corporate interests, but really in service of the public interest. It's really changed the dynamic of doing this, so I think it still means that this program is important. But it does make me feel like often I'm just one of a thousand voices, but I think it's a good thing and really a mark of how the public interest community and really the efforts to reform the media have gotten stronger and are able to put pressure on the FCC and Congress, although it is a very pitched battle nevertheless. So getting back into the news, going back to this meeting of the 26th, the FCC, the other big thing had to do with cable. Chairman Martin has decided that he thinks that it's time for cable to be regulated. And one of the things in the current statutes about cable is that it is subject to regulation, specifically with regard to ensuring level of diversity in offerings, once the industry has passed what is called the 70-70 threshold. And that's when 70% of all U.S. television households, with 70% of those households subscribing to cable. So at that moment is when cables open up to a whole new level of regulation. Chairman Martin says that it has happened. However, his fellow Republicans on the commission do not yet agree. He had one particular study that he was pushing to his fellow commissioners, saying that this particular threshold had been passed. And in fact, a study, a check of the numbers by the Media Access Project, said those numbers are legit. But his fellow Republicans are still questioning it and put up quite a fight Tuesday night, to the extent to which his declaration did not pass. In fact, it didn't come up for a vote. Martin was forced to take a step back, even though he had the support of his fellow of the Democrats on the commission. But all of the commissioners seem to be a little bit skeptical about the way that Chairman Martin is playing his hand with regard to coming forward with really only one data set and being a bit cagey about that data set, and cagey, in fact, about a lot of the data sets that he's bringing up with regard to trying to vouch for particular policy changes. So instead of declaring that the cable industry is now subject to regulation, instead the FCC has said that they're going to do a little more study on it and now have required all cable companies have 60 days to file statistics on the number of homes the operator passes and a number of subscribers the operator serves. And by means, the homes that the operator passes, number of homes that the cable company could serve, currently is built out and ready to serve if that household decided to actually subscribe. What's interesting about this little bit of inside politics going on at the FCC is Chairman Martin is now suffering something that he kind of dealt out to former Chairman Powell some 4 years ago when he crucially dissented with Powell on a piece of telecom regulation, siding with the FCC's two Democrats against him, handing Powell a kind of sharp defeat. And that happens because most of these deals are worked out ahead of time by the commissioners. It's very rare to see a heavy amount of dissent, especially amongst a party. There's three Republicans, two Democrats. The majority is always the same majority that's in the executive, in the presidency. And so there aren't too many surprises. There generally aren't too many upsets happening when it comes right down to a vote, although these things sometimes do happen. And it was a big surprise when Martin decided to dissent with Powell at that time, and it seems like maybe he's getting a taste of his own medicine. But Martin also is still pushing on the cable TV ownership issue on regulation, because the day after the FCC meeting on the 26th, on Wednesday, it turned out that he's told other FCC members that they should be prepared on the next meeting, December 18th, on rules that would reinstate cable system ownership limits, which have lain dormant since 2001 after a federal appeals court held that the agency's cable restrictions were unconstitutional. The FCC's old rule barred one company from serving more than 30% of cable subscribers nationally, and he'd like to see that rule put back into effect. And this one particularly seems aimed at Comcast, which is the nation's largest cable company and the second largest internet service provider in the country, and has also been subject to a little bit of scrutiny for how it treats its internet traffic, which I'll get to in a moment. But it would Comcast is currently at 27%, serves 27% of TV subscribers nationally, and so it would be barred then, if this were to pass, from acquiring its competitors like Charter or Time Warner, who are some of the other big players in the cable TV market, which is something certainly Comcast would like to do if it can, to expand both its internet business and its cable business. And so that looks to be something that will be coming up on December 18th. Of course, also at December 18th is when Chairman Martin would like to see his fellow commissioners vote on his new proposals to loosen media ownership rules. And it seems as though public opinion is coming out very strongly against this relaxation, which would permit the co-ownership of TV stations and newspapers in the top markets in the United States. This has been allowed to a large extent by individual waivers given by the FCC, but it has not across the board been allowed. One thing in particular that's hinging on this is the deal to sell Tribune Company, make it private, to Chicago based billionaire Zell Miller. It seems like that deal is falling on the rocks because one of the things that he wants out of the deal is to be able to continue to own a TV station, WGN, and a newspaper, the Chicago Tribune in Chicago, which is not necessarily guaranteed as part of the deal. He's hoping that the FCC would act and extend the waiver that currently exists to Zell Miller, but that has not happened. And perhaps is also hoping that this new loosened regulation would pass, and we don't know whether that'll happen. Of course, people are also very annoyed. They only dropped the idea of this particular loosening last month. It seems to be really pushing this through, and we also wonder whether Chairman Martin is losing a little bit of his sway with his fellow commissioners, whether Democrat or Republican, because of his tactics of holding back some data and pushing things through pretty quickly. One thing I do want to get to real quick is mentioning that something pretty historic happened in New Jersey on Wednesday, November 28th, hearing at Rutgers University about a license challenge against WWOR-TV, Channel 9 in Secaucus, New Jersey. So actually a public hearing. Very rarely that there is this level of investigation against about people challenging the license renewal of a TV station. But this is because the people of New Jersey think that WWOR is not actually servicing the state of New Jersey and instead oriented towards New York City. The Voice of New Jersey, which is the group that filed the challenge, reports that the station ran 1,354 New Jersey news stories between 1999 and 2006, an average of fewer than 100 stories a year, or one every 2 days. And of course, this is a station with a nightly news broadcast, supposedly serving the state of New Jersey with 7 million people. WWR was purchased by Fox in 2001. It's based in Secaucus, New Jersey. Promotes itself, though, as My 9 New York. And the homepage and the station's website up until Wednesday night featured an image of the New York skyline. Less than 2 hours after the hearing, WWOR replaced the skyline image with one of the George Washington Bridge, which connects New Jersey with Manhattan. It is the only VHF station in the entire state. Other things that the residents of New Jersey cite as evidence that it's not serving the state well is that WWOR actually closed its news bureau in Trenton, which is the seat of government, and 3 years ago had proposed to consolidate operations with its Channel 5 station in New York City and only reversed itself after coming under fire from critics and New Jersey's congressional delegation. And WWOR is actually kind of a special case. It started out in New York, and the station was located there until 1982 when General Tire and Rubber, which then owned the station, faced losing the license because of a corporate misconduct scandal. Then that year, Congress passed a law saying that any station that moved to New Jersey would have its license automatically renewed. And that was because New Jersey did not have any VHF stations. The FCC, when it approved WWOR's move to New Jersey, said it expected the station to, quote, provide a higher degree of service, end quote, than is normally required under a broadcast license. And at the hearing, Commissioner Adelstein acknowledged that this has never happened. So it does seem unlikely that the license will be denied, the license renewal will be denied, but it is nevertheless interesting to see a license renewal get this much scrutiny in this day and age. It used to happen a lot more. If we go back 30 years or so, back to the 70s and before then, license renewals were not pro forma affairs like they are now. And very often, the performance of a station with regard to its local community, with regard to service, with regard to news and public affairs programming was looked at very carefully as part of the license renewal process, and stations often were given provisional licenses or given shorter license renewal stages during which time they're expected to enhance and make their service better in order to get their full approval. And the last thing I just want to note is that the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has released a report saying that it has confirmed the fact that Comcast Cable is interfering with the traffic of its broadband users using something called packet spoofing in order to block the use of peer-to-peer technologies like Nutella or BitTorrent. And EFF is saying that this is not just merely about Comcast being able to manage its traffic with the assumption that somehow that people who use peer-to-peer technologies are using more traffic than others, because they found that the blocking happens even with very small files on connections that are not passing a lot of data. So they're definitely discriminating towards particular types of traffic. And at the same time, the EFF has released a set of tools to help people detect whether or not packet spoofing is going on. You can find that at their website at EFF.org. That's the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. KQRP in Salida, California. KRBS in Oroville, California. WSLR in Sarasota, Florida. WTND, Macomb, Illinois. WRFA in Jamestown, New York. CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia. WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia. KWMD, Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska. WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont. And Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.